Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is the Red, White, and Rude, where politics is downstream of culture, and I am here to break it all down. That said, we don't always talk politics and culture. Sometimes we talk just culture. Actually, we talk about that every episode, just culture, because it's fun. It's one of the things that makes America great. It's not true. Every country has their own form of pop culture and culture. But today we're going to talk about the main topic actually is my favorite show has been canceled. Frasier canceled. From fan love to fan disappointment. A harsh reality check. And from there we're going to get right into the Rude Rundown, where we're going to talk some Hollywood, some harsh realities in politics and culture, and some gaming news. But before we go on, don't forget to like and share this podcast. But you can also find this podcast, Red, White, and Rude, as well as others like it at grumblingsmedia.com and our YouTube and Rumble channels, as well as traditional podcast outlets such as Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the profile Grumblings Media. We thank you for your support. We truly do. We are an all-volunteer unit here, and your help is truly appreciated. And one way you can do it is just by subscribing and sharing. All right, let's get down to it. Well, in sad news, I learned this past week that my favorite show, Frasier, was canceled. And the honest truth about all this is that it was canceled, but got to be honest, it kind of deserved to be canceled. Paramount Plus has decided not to renew Frasier for a third season, despite all the initial buzz and positive reception it got, which I thought was more along the lines of people didn't care for it, but just couldn't knock it. The plot around the revival had Frasier moving back to Boston. And for Frasier fans, all of you know this, I'm sure. But for those of you who aren't quite aware, he moved back to Boston to reconnect with his son, Freddie, who is now a young adult. Well, not really young, in his early 30s. And he took up a position at Harvard. And it attempted to blend new stories with the established character's legacy. And we were hoping for greatness, to be quite honest. But I was also a realist in my expectations. And the cast consisted of Kelsey Grammer, obviously returning as Frasier, Crane, but the show lacked the original members. None of the original members came back to the show, and it was original ensemble's chemistry that made the original so good. It was an ensemble show, and the new characters just failed to capture that same audience affection. It didn't with me. So CBS Studios, seeing potential in the IP, is going to shop Frasier to other platforms like Prime Video and Hulu being considered. I hope somebody picks it up, and we're going to talk about what it should do if it is picked up. The series struggled to gain a significant traction, obviously, on Paramount Plus since it was let go or canceled. And maybe it's because of the platform's focus on drama rather than comedy. At least that's what some of my research bore out, and the revival's inability to resonate with a broad audience. You know, that's a Taylor Sheridan streaming service. It's all over the top dramas, which I don't even watch. The only reason I subscribed to Paramount Plus was because of Frasier, and we're letting this month run out, and then we are canceling it. No specific reasons were given for the cancellation, and some fans, not me, and some analysts are speculating on viewership metrics and if it was indeed a cultural fit. Myself, I just didn't care for it. I kept hoping it would improve. I kept wanting to like it, and I just couldn't. It's pretty much that simple, you know. So both seasons will remain on Paramount Plus for people to check out. And I actually have seen the original series about two or three times, to be honest. The future hopes, obviously there's optimism for the show's revival elsewhere. And there's been a discussion about incorporating more Cheers characters for a nostalgic boost. We're going to talk about that as well. The cancellation does reflect a broader fan disappointment, where even diehard fans such as myself hoped for but didn't experience a revival that lived up to the original's legacy. And as I said, Paramount Plus lured me in with the Frasier revival, but it's like I gave it season one. I was disappointed. So I gave it season two. And the performance was so disappointing that I told the better half, I said, you know, I want it to work, but we're going to unsubscribe to Paramount Plus. You know, we've enjoyed a few shows here or there, but there's nothing special about Paramount Plus. And I have no interest again in their over the top Taylor Sheridan dramas. And I doubt I'll come back. In fact, speaking of Taylor Sheridan dramas, their biggest one, the one with Kevin Costner, or minus Kevin Costner, the final second half of the final season, it rated no pop culture interest. Before this long hiatus, you used to see all the articles written about it. It was water cooler talk. That kind of went away with this final season. The thing with when you're paying somebody like Taylor Sheridan that much money, you've got to bring in new subscribers. And I truly wonder if his show is doing just that. So back to Frasier. The lack of character, love, and chemistry. The absence of stars like David Hyde Pierce and the death of John Mahoney actually left a big void. His chemistry with his brother was everything to the show, with the father being the mediary, the person in the middle, as well as having to deal with his issues, him and Frasier. It created this dynamic that just captured so much magic. And the new cast interactions, especially Frasier and Freddie, his son, it just didn't give us that warmth or humor, the original. It was just missing the spark. I don't know how the interactions felt forced in the show, not just with Freddie, but with all of them. Then they had the introduction of Alan, Frasier's supposed best friend. And it was unconvincing from the get-go because, again, a lack of chemistry. And as a season two, it was a little bit better, but he was never mentioned in the original series. So they failed to establish a believable relationship there. They should never have said it was his best friend. He should have been a new character that maybe he knew or had a relationship with, or even better, had a falling out with. That's why he was never mentioned. Yeah, it could have been overcome had there been character death. And there was none. Unlike the original, when here's the thing about the original. Even minor characters had depth. Gil, the chef, I can't remember the Star Trek geek. They all had depth. Bulldog obviously had depth. They had minor storylines at times, but you didn't see them every episode. But they still had depth. And this reiteration, the new characters, like the ones in Freddie is a fireman. So they had minor characters who were firemen and women there. And none of them had any substance to them. They had one named Moose. But they made him a dumbass, you know, an idiot. You know, he didn't have any substance at all. He was like a dumb Kenny, but just dumber and dumber and dumber. Kenny was smart. He was naive. Moose was naive, but just dumb. Dumb as a rock. And his character fell flat. And this absence of character development was obviously a stark contrast to the original show's rich character arcs. Then there was the underused guest stars. You know, Roz came back for a few episodes, and she was kind of like a semi-regular by season two, but her presence was underwhelming. I mean, her roles and storylines, they didn't capitalize on her potential for adding depth or humor. And these cameos or storylines with her, they were pretty forgettable and ineffective. They didn't have the same magic. And maybe because they were trying to give her an equal standing with Frasier on the show, I don't know. It just wasn't there. The real reason for the demise was a lack of narrative and creative execution. The script quality was less witty, less sharp compared to the original. The humor that was forced, it just wasn't there. The plot development, you know, the narratives from Frasier's move to Boston and the job at Harvard, you know, we got it with his ex-wife. Oh my God, I am drawing a blank on his ex-wife. Oh my God, what is the ex-wife's name? Lilith. That's it, Lilith. Oh my God. So we saw his move to Seattle made sense from the fact of being divorced from Lilith. And it just didn't, the magic wasn't there, or the believability of him leaving his show, which is like Dr. Phil in Chicago, to go to Boston. In fact, I think they should have taken the Dr. Phil format that Frasier was a star in in terms of the backstory and made that the front story. He moves to Boston to be closer to his son, but he still has his show. Would have been much better than the Harvard scenario. The Harvard scenario failed to engage the viewers and it lacked complexity of the original's plots. Actually, it wasn't a lot of complexity, a lot of moving parts, but they weren't complex. That's just it. There are a lot of moving parts that worked well in the original, but it was still so simple and funny. This was not funny. Moving to Boston suggested a connection to Cheers, and that also raised expectations in terms of plot development. But there were no Cheers characters. The absence of the iconic Cheers figures was a significant oversight, and they missed the chance to enrich the narrative, obviously with nostalgia. And then ignoring the bar, not revisiting the Cheers bar, whether logistically challenging or not, meaning they had to rebuild a set, was a letdown, neglecting fan expectations. They could have had a couple, they could have had a subset of Cheers once a season or twice a season going there with Sam and the rest of the characters. It was obviously a missed opportunity. The setup in Boston promised more than it delivered, leading to plots lacking depth and engagement of the original due to unfulfilled fan hopes. So in other words, we were expecting some Cheers interaction and got none of it. Audience reception? Have we changed culturally that much? No. Frasier is a series that transcends generations. Outside of the technology scenes, like seeing Niles Crane, the brother, with a big old cell phone, you know, the size of a book. You know, outside of that, the plots and the storylines transcend generations, and it's still as funny today as it was back then. The truth is, the revival was always going to struggle to meet the high expectations set by its predecessors. And fans, some fans were saying, you know, it's going to dilute the show's legacy. I don't see that at all. The show, original show, will always stand on its own, and this reincarnation will just fade into memory. Now, just because this failed doesn't mean that shows set from the 90s and characters of that era, you can't bring them back in different formats. You know, you have a show like Hot in Cleveland. We're going to talk about that. It managed to capture audiences by blending nostalgia with new content in a way that resonated. That's one of my top five shows. And it's about older women, you know. Now, some people talk about changing taste. And sure, it's true. The comedy landscape has evolved. It's not that it's evolved. It's cyclical. You'll see years where there's the traditional sitcom, there's a minimal of them, and then you'll see years when the market's flooded with them. However, shows like Hot in Cleveland and Animal Control, a fairly new show, not a huge hit show, but it's funny and it has a cool audience already. It demonstrates that there's still an appetite for the traditional sitcom format, especially when you have fresh takes, as in Hot in Cleveland, or leverage familiar faces in new contexts, Hot in Cleveland as well, and Animal Control taking some known names and branding them together. And what works? It's the chemistry. Animal Control is a show that is built upon chemistry. I was just talking to Better Half. I'm like, I don't know why we like this show. And it's obvious. It's the chemistry. Hot in Cleveland succeeded partly because it appealed to an underserved demographic with its humor and cast. Again, the women were in their late 40s, or the women were in their 50s. And Betty White was the gem in the show in her 80s rather. Animal Control has shown that with the right mix of comedy elements and character development, even a new entry into the sitcom genre can find an audience. So the issue with the Frasier revival might not be the format, but rather the execution. In fact, that's what I say it is. It's the execution. Even the sets were bland. It had that dull office type lighting. But in essence, it wasn't really even that, but as much as the execution and capturing the essence of what made the original a beloved show while trying to adapt to contemporary tastes of today. That's what some critics say, and I agree with it to a degree. Now, success on the platform. What platform are you on? As well as effective marketing, adapting again to modern taste, and the show's quality all fit in. But let's talk about platform. Had this show been on Prime or maybe Netflix, and maybe it would have done better. It was on Paramount Plus, and that obviously prioritizes dramas. And it might have led to less aggressive marketing because it was a Frasier name, or it'll carry itself. Excuse me. And with so many streaming services, so many various comedies on these various streaming services, the market's diluted. And unless you are a truly exceptional show that can stick out, you're going to struggle. And I believe that's what happened to Frasier. I think it would have done better on Hulu, on NBC Peacock. In fact, Hulu and NBC Peacock, NBC was original network. That would have leveraged some of the nostalgia of potentially attracting some viewers. And Hulu, the original series has been airing there forever. So those would have been two obviously better fits. And then Amazon Prime is worldwide and would have given them a wide audience there. So ratings and viewership, we don't know. Exact figures are not disclosed by streaming services. But the cancellation suggests Frasier didn't meet viewership expectations. And there's also, you need to bring in new subscribers. Maybe it didn't do that. The word of mouth, well, not just from critics, but even fans are like, eh, we wouldn't knock it because we loved it so much, the Frasier original show. But the truth of the matter is, it was not a very good show. Again, CBS is looking elsewhere to place a show, indicating a belief in the IP, but not in its current home on Paramount Plus, aiming for a better fit. That's the first step. Now, I plan on sending this as a clip over to the Paramount, to the Frasier people, because if picked up, Suzanne Martin is the key to success. Why? And who is Suzanne Martin? Well, Suzanne Martin's proven success is her work on Hot in Cleveland. I believe she's the show's creator. It demonstrated her ability to not only create a show that blends nostalgia with contemporary humor, making her the ideal candidate to revitalize Frasier by leveraging her understanding of character dynamics and audience appeal. Now, why do I say that? You can sit there and say, well, there's tons of comedies that have done that. Well, here's why. First of all, her work spans from Frasier. That's right. She was on Frasier as a writer to Hot in Cleveland, showcasing her talent. And her pivotal role on Frasier, or her, that pivotal time in her life on Frasier, gives her a deep understanding of the character's dynamics. Her contributions, I don't know if they were crucial or not, but it helped shape the series' comedic style and character interactions. And she could potentially recapture some of Frasier Crane's essence in the new show. She has a connection to the cast, obviously. Her success with Frasier alumni on Hot in Cleveland, which included the late, great John Mahoney, Jane Leaves was on there. You saw a couple of the minor characters show up on Hot in Cleveland. And not only that, she was able to get people from that generation as guest stars on the show. It demonstrated her ability to leverage past relationships for new and greater achievements. Her show, Hot in Cleveland, is her pinnacle of success for now. I'm sure she's still writing. So from Frasier to Hot in Cleveland, again, Martin excels in crafting character-driven narratives. We loved Hot in Cleveland, my wife and I. And we don't deal with commercials anymore. We don't like shows. But we suffered through those commercials because the show was so funny. She can help rejuvenate the revival with deep, engaging character arcs. She blends wit with physical comedy, and that will appeal to Frasier's original demographic. Frasier, there was nobody on Frasier that was like Jack Tripper from Three's Company, but the show had that feel. And again, her strategic use of guest stars could bridge the past and present, attracting both old and new fans. So there's one of the original writers, Ken Levine. He had a few years ago, he had a podcast, and I'm not sure, some of my notes were based off some of the articles, but I did hear the podcast, so I assume a lot of these articles where I got my data from was from that podcast. But he was an original Frasier writer. He criticized the revival for not capturing the show's magic, suggesting that new writers, despite being fans, they missed the essence. Martin's connection to the, Levine's connection to the original could ensure a more authentic tribute to Frasier's history. And understanding that that history, Levine highlighted the revival's failure to integrate Frasier's backstory. And that led to a fan disconnect, such as Alan being his best friend. We're like, eh, never mentioned the Frasier's universe before this. You know? He criticized the new show for focusing on generic humor, yes. Silliness, yes. over nuanced storytelling. I said the silliness part, but Frasier was always silly, but it was a funny silly, and it always mattered and integrated into the storyline, and it used the characters or the actors' natural ability to enhance the silliness. This is all forced on the new Frasier. So maybe you get Levine involved, it could provide a more respectful blend of the past and the present. Some of his other criticism I agreed with. He noted changes in Frasier's personality, missing the original's nuanced growth. Levine found the revival's humor less sharp than the original's intelligent wit. Woo! He hit that one on the money. The lack of chemistry. He compared the new cast unfavorably to the original's dynamic interactions. I wholeheartedly agree. And again, it's not that I disliked the new cast. It's just there was no chemistry. Individually, I saw the characters, even Alan, towards the second season. But it's just his character just didn't seem to fit properly. He also thought there was a misuse of the legacy. He felt the revival didn't fully embrace Frasier's unique qualities, and it squandered the chance for a loving homage. Look at Hot in Cleveland. It just when I saw Hot in Cleveland, I told my wife before I realized who Suzanne Martin was. I was like, this show just reminds me of Frasier. She's like, well, it's Shane Leaves. Daphne's on there. And I was like, no. Sure, that's part of it, I guess. But it was just the comedic writing, the timing, the storylines, the nuances, the chemistry between the characters, the building up of the characters over the seasons. It just was Frasier style all the way. So involving Suzanne Martin could be pivotal for Frasier's success on another platform. You can leverage her proven track record and deep series connection. You bring in Levine as well. And he can significantly enhance the narrative quality and character development, making the show's true roots while continuing to innovate it. Maybe both of them being part of the revival on a different platform may rekindle enthusiasm, bringing us old viewers back and obviously building on new viewers. And I'm sure Levine probably has a deep Rolodex too. Both, especially Martin, could orchestrate appearances that celebrate the show's history, possibly including, or actually, most definitely, including Cheers connections. The Frasier revival's cancellation by Paramount Plus underscores the difficulty of recapturing the beloved show's magic. Frasier is testament to that. Despite the initial excitement, it struggled with humor, character depth, and obviously chemistry. For Frasier to thrive, if it is picked up, it's going to require someone like a Suzanne Martin's innovative touch and Ken Levine's legacy-focused insights to ensure character consistency and a blend of nostalgia with new storytelling. Developing an actual chemistry among the cast where the show can shine is what will allow it to succeed. And obviously, effective marketing will be crucial for all of this. And there you have it. Tell me your thoughts on the Frasier revival, what your thoughts were on the first two seasons in comparison to the original, and if you think it should be brought up. All right, then. Let's get down to it. The Rude Rundown. And we are going to start here with news and politics, the CNN lawsuit. So for those of you who may not realize it, a jury found CNN guilty of defamation against a United States Navy veteran, a brother of mine as a veteran, Zachary Young, in a ruling that the network smeared him by implying he illegally profited from helping people flee Afghanistan during the 2021 military withdrawal. After 8 hours of deliberation, CNN was held responsible for not only compensatory, but punitive damages as well. The jury awarded Young a total of $5 million, which included $4 million in lost earnings and $1 million in personal damages for pain and suffering. The decision also indicated that punitive damages were warranted against CNN. And that was a phase we were getting ready to enter. And one analyst indicated $150 million in punitive damages would not be shocking. CNN saw the tea leaves finally. Young refused to settle during the trial, but at this point, he and his team felt, we've proven our point. So they did open the door to a settlement, and you know it was a big old settlement. So before reaching that separate phase of punitive damages, CNN and Zachary Young reached an undisclosed settlement, which concluded the case without further jury deliberations. What do I speculate? What is the rude take? I speculate that CNN may have acted arrogantly, defending the indefensible, relying on the New York Times Company versus Sullivan SCOTUS ruling. And the ruling requires public figures defined as those who are famous or deeply involved in public controversies to prove actual malice. And what that means is, and the meaning is, the defendant knew the statement was false or showed reckless disregard for its truth for defamation claims. Now, the courts, especially the activist judges, have actually always defended this above and beyond what they should, including non-public figures suing. They've, in essence, been an ally of the fake news flat-out lying. And CNN might have wrongly assumed, despite Young not being a public figure, but that the court would have ruled for them based on the Sullivan ruling as they had before, despite the fact many cases show blatant lying by the media. Well, it's not despite the fact. Well, despite the fact, yeah, that many cases show blatant lying by the media, and the court still ruled in favor for the media. Well, this strategy backfired this time as Young's team constantly caught CNN in lies. They were arrogant in attacking Young for no reason but malice and knowing the story was full of holes and should never have aired. The team of Young was able to prove that, and CNN was its own worst enemy at times. What made it worse was CNN came out and officially said, well, we're not going to post this online. There's just too many holes. I don't want to say that was the icing on the cake, but that had a big hand. And actually, all of it had a big hand. The line, the videos, the emails, there was a lot of evidence, and it showed ESPN. And ESPN, in their defense, wanted to settle. They probably weren't offering much or at that, and Young wanted to prove his innocence. Obviously, this led to a $5 million award against them, CNN, with the potential of a punitive award being over $100 million. So they chose to settle. I wouldn't be surprised if they gave him $50 million. We need more of these types of decisions. We need to take the fake news of the mat. And I don't say that hating the fake news. I say that hating the media that has betrayed its constituent. The media is supposed to be there for us, we the people. The pen is mightier than the sword, but instead they have become allies to ideological politics, and they have become our enemy. They view us as the uneducated savage. All right, let's move on. Some more news and politics. This time we are going to head on over to Jim Acosta. So Jim Acosta is moving to the midnight time slot. From the morning, I believe. Morning time slot. CNN framed Acosta's new slot as West Coast prime time, 9 to 11 p.m. But this is thinly veiled fact because he has no influence and his viewership numbers are significantly down. In the midnight slot, they can kind of hide him. It's an embarrassing demotion for a journalist who saw himself as central to the network's identity. Bottom line, it's poor ratings. Look, his 10 a.m. Eastern Time show had some of CNN's lowest ratings. It revealed his limited appeal beyond political confrontations, despite his high regard for himself. At the 10 a.m. time slot, his show was drawing around 511,000 viewers on some of his better days, notably lower than what was expected or typical for that time slot. That was his better days. The show was averaging about 322,000 total viewers. I mean, nobody's watching CNN is what this boils down to. Some people said, well, William, his show's ratings are pretty good. Yeah, in context of this loser slide they're on the last couple of years, but not in CNN's heyday. And he's not going to improve their numbers for one simple reason. CNN is seen as a leftist fake news studio. And I'm going to have a podcast on what CNN needs to do if they want to become a player in the news game again. Jim Acosta demoted to the midnight slot And they were able to pull it off by telling them, you're in prime time on the West Coast. What a moron. And I bottom line it with, he finally realized what they were doing and is thinking of leaving. But where is he going to go? Wherever he goes is going to be at a major, major pay cut. And can his ego take that? We'll wait. We'll find out soon enough, won't we? All right. Let's move on to culture and politics. Barack and Michael. Barack and Michelle. A love story. Rumors of a marriage in crisis. There's speculation about the end of Barack and Michelle Obama's marriage, and it's been rampant. Some sources suggest that the couple's relationship has reached its end. Now, some of these rumors gain traction and claims of discord are fueled by public statements and social media gossip by legitimate people, people who are in the know. They're stating that the once celebrated union may be on the rocks. Obviously, we all know about Michelle's notable absences. She refused to go to Jimmy Carter's funeral and Donald Trump's inauguration, and that's been interpreted as a sign of marital trouble. Well, I think she's full of vile, evil, and hate, and that's part of the reason that, you know, the fact that she, her marriage is in trouble. You know, this was like, well, I'm not there to support you anymore, and I don't like those people anyway. So obviously, all that has fed into the narrative of marriage in distress. Then there's a Jennifer Aniston rumors. Woohoo! Friends not being friends. Aniston has given it a firm denial. Jennifer Aniston has denied any romantic involvement with Barack Obama, stating on Jimmy Kimmel Live last year in October that she's only met him once and knows Michelle better. Despite denials, rumors persist with anonymous sources again claiming Aniston's friends had confirmed the relationship. Of course, we have no evidence. So there's been tabloids like In Touch running stories suggesting a romance, again, with no evidence. Obama's response? Well, Barack has not directly addressed the rumors. But he did post a birthday tribute to Michelle, which was not an attractive picture. I put that picture up of my better half. She's going to knock me out. I've never found Michelle attractive anyway. I think her attractive has been nothing but fake news media propping her up. I view her along the lines of Bush Sr. and his wife. And I'm not knocking them. God bless these women. God bless these men, I guess. You know, it's just not my taste. You know, I'm like, when I see the Vanity Fairs, the most beautiful woman in the country, I'm like, oh, who are they talking about? However, by not addressing the Aniston rumors, he's throwing shade on the he's gay crowd. So he's a smart man. And for those talking, wait, why do you say that? Well, there was a 1982 letter to his girlfriend that Barack wrote. This is fact. In a letter to his then-girlfriend, Alex McNear, a 21-year-old Barack Obama wrote about his androgynous mind and admitted to fantasizing about making love, chicka-down, to men in his imagination. This philosophical exploration has been taken out of context, maybe. Maybe not. Who knows? Maybe he wrote it in a fantasy way, but was just projecting what was really happening. Who knows? But the 1982 letter to the girlfriend, Alex McNear, is factual. Then there's the Larry Sinclair allegations. This cracks me up. Women who have never met Trump, been near Trump, they make a rape statement or they did a type statement, and all of a sudden they're all over it. Where was the media with Larry Sinclair's allegations? In 2008, Larry Sinclair, a man with a claim he had sexual encounters with Obama in the late 1990s. That was never fully investigated by the mainstream media. Why? It was kept on the down low. Regardless, who knows about Michelle and Obama's relationship? To be quite frank, I don't care. I'm talking about it to you guys because it's in the news and it's fun to poke a bear, to poke fun at it. But outside of that, do we really care? Let the former first couple, Obama and Big Mike, and leave them in private. I'm sorry. Did I say Big Mike? I meant Michelle. Let's move on. Hollywood. Oscars nominate a man for best female actress. This one blew my mind. So here we have it. Carla Sofía Gascón has been nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars for Emilia Perez. As the first openly transgender person, or is the first openly transgender person to receive this reward. So you see the picture there. On the left is Juan Carlos Gascón. It's a common Cuban name. I'm sure there's other cultures with it, but it's a common Cuban name. Juan Gascón is now Carla Sofía Gascón. Again, nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars for Emilia Perez. So the question arises whether Gascón, who has undergone gender reassignment surgery to transition from male to female, should be considered a woman for the nomination. He is what you would call now a woman on the outside artificially, but a man on the inside with XY chromosomes. But that's not even the worst part about it. It's the premise of this film. Emilia Perez is a musical. Go to YouTube and type in the movie Emilia Perez and look at some of the songs. You would think it was done by some frat boys in college. It's that bad. But it's a musical that follows the story of a transgender Mexican cartel leader who fakes her death to transition and start a new life, aiming to atone for past sins. I got news for you. The first hit by the new cartel head would have been on Emilia Perez. The narrative has been criticized for its execution and perceived lack of taste. Nobody saw this movie. Its gross worldwide was $10.8 million. Its budget was $26 million, which means its break-even point was $78 million. Ergo, it was a flop, a bomb. Nobody saw it. And this falls under Hollywood's woke dilemma. The nomination of Gascón has likely irked many in Hollywood, especially the women, because they might feel a coveted spot was taken by a man. However, the irony is that this same Hollywood crowd that has pushed for inclusiveness and a woke culture is now potentially forced into silence on the issue. They're unable to voice discontent without undermining their own advocacy. This is a backlash of their own making where the principles they champion are now applied against them. Because this is a group of people who believe in do as I say, not as I do, meaning they want all this woke being put on us, the common bourgeois folks, but not on them. And now it's on them. We'll see what happens here, but I hope Emilia Perez wins it all. It's been nominated for multiple Oscar nominations. And I hope Carla Sofía Gascón takes Best Female Actress. Oh, it's too rich. Too rich. All right. Let us move on. Tim Allen, shifting gears. I have to be honest, I have seen the first two episodes. I am not that impressed. Shifting Gears by Tim Allen, though. However, I may not be impressed. It hit a six-year high for ABC with nearly 17 million viewers across platforms. And the critics give it a 42% Rotten Tomatoes score, showing a hate for anything conservative. But regardless, the viewing numbers are a 173% increase from live plus same day viewership. The critical reception, obviously, 42% Rotten Tomatoes score. The critics have panned Shifting Gears for its predictable humor and lack of innovation contributing to that RT score. So there's obviously a big disconnect between critics and audience. My take, there's been nothing but a critic's bias against Tim Allen once he came out as conservative. They gave harsh reviews because of his conservative views. They saw his political statements as dangerous that he's making, still continues to make, and has made in the past. And yet they use their reviews to hurt and attack him indirectly, trying to curb his viewership. Obviously, it's failed. Honestly, Kat Dennings is what drives me nuts. She's got this high, shrilly voice. But I see the premise. I see how it can be used. They need to use Spicoli. I forget his name, the actor's name, but he's from American Pie. They need to bring him out more. They need to develop his character more. My understanding is they're going to develop him and Kat Dennings. But overall, I'm not going to turn it off, but it's not one of my favorite shows. Moving on. Mel Gibson's latest flick, Flight Risk. Well, here's another one like Mel Gibson. I mean, like Tim Allen. They're going to knock it to knock it. I got a picture of it somewhere around here. Where'd it go? There it is. Flight Risk. It actually has Mark Wahlberg in it as well, and it's directed by Mel Gibson. Mark Wahlberg, despite his Christian Catholic beliefs, is still beloved by all. So they're not going to attack him directly. Some do, but for the most part, he's managed to escape the cancellation that they've given to Mel Gibson. So Flight Risk opened with an estimated $12 million in revenue, secured the number one spot at the box office for this past weekend. But that's a weak opening. Despite this, it was Gibson's lowest opening weekend as a director in 30 years, highlighting a significant departure from his previous box office successes. That is, this movie's going to tank. I mean, you don't open with $12 million and expect great numbers long-term unless word of mouth gets around. It stars Mark Wahlberg, Michelle Dockery, and Topher Grace. And it's, again, Gibson's lowest rated directorial effort to date with a 26% Rotten Tomato score. I said again, but that's separate from the money. But critics don't like it. It seems, despite being number one, $12 million, it's not getting its due with viewers. Supposedly has a lack of suspense, poor pacing, and people view it as more direct to streaming release than a theatrical release. And you can see that. There's a lot of movies on Netflix from big superstars. You're like, yeah, this would have bombed at the box office. Wahlberg has come out and defended the film, highlighting its unique tension and his dark character. You know, at the end of the day, the critical backlash is meant to tarnish Gibson's legacy. I mean, he's had hits like Hacksaw Ridge, Passion of the Christ, and Apocalypto. So this isn't really going to taint his legacy. Gibson faces disdain from the left, Hollywood, and mainstream media due to his outspoken conservative views, his commitment to traditionalist Catholicism, and his tendency to speak candidly. Now, part of this is fueled because he does have past controversies, has made anti-Semitic statements. And it's been widely publicized, and it's overshadowed his achievements. But he's paid his penance, and he's back on top again. And they still don't want to let go and forgive. Only the left can be forgiven. Any conservatives will never be forgiven. But part of that is because Gibson is refusing to conform to Hollywood's often liberal narrative, and his critique of modern culture shifts have made him a polarizing figure on the left. And that will always impact the reception of his films. They'll always knock his films, regardless if they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. And he's also one of President Trump's ambassadors to Hollywood. So they're going to do everything to try to destroy any work he puts forward. Moving on. Culture and women. Brazilian butt lifts are in the news. And I'm not going to post a pic of the before and afters. But look, a debate has surfaced that BBLs that are popular among celebrities, especially in music, reflect real societal trends and aren't just a social media hype. There's concerns, again, about unrealistic beauty standards and the pressure on women to conform. The issue here is the health risks. It's arguably some of the most dangerous cosmetic surgeries you can have. My take, look, Hollywood and culture media, they have pushed these views onto American women. I did a study on this in college, a paper in college, and it's Hollywood has a big hand in this, as well as the music industry. How women look is how young women and adult young women and even older women want to be seen. And it's not just women, but women in power too, that promote this look, because the bottom line is making money. So even a natural curvy look and keeping it real for women who don't have that naturally curvy look makes them want to get that curvy look. So they get fat, then they get these Brazilian butt lifts, and then they get a boob job. It's, again, Hollywood has a big hand in this. A Hollywood that is also run by women. What does this say about society that it can so easily do this to women? All right. Hollywood and gaming. Sonic the Hedgehog 3 has been released. I have not seen that. It's actually on Paramount Plus, I believe. Some of these movies, the Sonic the Hedgehog series, I just haven't bothered. I'm too old for that. The Sonic the Hedgehog 3 has grossed over $440 million, but Keanu Reeves' portrayal of Shadow has supposedly divided fans. While some celebrate his nuanced performance, others critique it for straying from the character's darker, more intense original design, igniting the discussions on adaption and representation. Look, I get it. The Sonic the Hedgehog is a kid's game. So how dark can it really be? The movie's success supposedly comes from a blend of action, humor, and emotional storytelling. Yet the mainstream media, who has no touch, doesn't know much, if anything, about the actual game, is diluting the essence of the Sonic video games. What I'm trying to say is they have no clue what they're talking about. It's a movie based off of kids' games. They're going to take Hollywood type of leads or angles with it, so be it. You're limited sometimes, but I'm not that familiar with the Sonic video games, and my hope is always to be canonic towards the game, and maybe that's what they're talking about here. However, I don't think they've lost much of their fan base with the fact that it's made so much money. You know, what I found interesting, what I really want to talk about here, is Jim Carrey's financial candidness about it all. Carrey returned as Dr. Robotnik. And he was saying this humorously, but he was admitting his motivation was financial, which is odd because Carrey's earned about $300 million in Hollywood. I looked it up. Now, his supporters say, well, this is actually refreshing, William. It shows authenticity in who he is as a human being and adds authenticity to his performance. And it highlights the financial pressures even top actors face. I use bull bleep. $300 million in your Hollywood career and you're seeing financial pressures? Please. Carrie's financial woes show him to be an idiot. Maybe inflation, maintenance costs, and declining passive income have compiled to him returning to acting. But his net worth after taxes and all that is about $180 million. So is it real estate? His Brentwood mansion struggled to sell. He dropped it from $29 million to $19 million, $10 million drop due to market conditions. It's more likely a lavish lifestyle, the Nicolas Cage story. Spending more than you're able to bring in. Luxury cars are a big cost item. Travel is always big when you're doing first class everything. Plus his art, his NFT ventures. Maybe all this is why he had to do Sonic. But maybe he was joking. Who knows? I would hope so. I don't care for the man. I think he's a very evil man. But it's always sad to see morons lose that much money. All right. Let us move on to gaming and Dragon Age and update here. So, in a previous podcast on the Red, White, and Rude, I talked about Dragon Age and how it was woke, how it was losing money. People were talking about it's a success. It's a success. Excuse me. How it's a success. And I'm like, no, the numbers don't add up. And sure enough, Electronic Arts revised its forecast downward due to an underwhelming performance from EA Sports FC 25 and Dragon Age The Veilguard. They reduced their fiscal year revenue expectations, and that caused a 16% drop in price, in stock price. Look, The Veilguard only attracted 1.5 million players, half of what EA anticipated, further impacting their financial forecast. The sales targets were not met. Critics who are woke and support wokeness praise the gameplay, while the narrative was criticized, potentially leading to negative reviews from YouTubers, not from the paid publications, who will get tens of thousands in advertising with the wink, wink, give us a good review strategy in place. On YouTube, it received nothing but negative reviews, and that word of mouth spread. I mentioned woke elements. It was woke. It did not alienate fans. It caused parents to realize, I can't buy this game for my kid because it's my job to teach my kid about transgenderism. sexuality, in essence, not a game to my 10-year-old kid. They're saying it also launched in a saturated market. And while that may be true, it has a rich history. It's a rich IP. But the fact is, when you go woke, you go broke. The fan base discontent in the series and its direction from previous successful titles did not appeal, and they did not buy into the wokeness. So my bottom line is that conservative boycotts are now making a difference. Go woke and go broke, and it's the parents' job to educate your kids, not a gaming company's. These transgender topics are for young adults to become educated about by young adult. I'm talking about high school level. And even then, they don't have the ability to make a decision to transition and have irreversible surgeries done until they are a legal adult. Because you can't come back from, I'm going to be a man again. Well, you just had your penis cut, man. You can't. I want to become a father, or I want to become a mother. You can't, because you no longer have ovaries and you no longer have the ability to create sperm. We've taken all that away. Irreversible surgeries should not be allowed to be done. And when you indoctrinate kids to want this and you have a society that is willing to do it, it's going to create lots of suicides down the road. I'm glad it failed because of that alone. All right, let us move on to our final topic here of the evening. It's gaming. Fortnite and Blade Runner. Fortnite, what's really popular in gaming right now is the ability to have skins, meaning you can play a certain character. So you just kind of, they put the character. Character really has nothing to do with the storyline as much as you play as that character looks. So leaks suggest a Blade Runner X Fortnite crossover, focusing on Blade Runner 2049. I don't know why I said X. We're Blade Runner and Fortnite crossover, focusing on Blade Runner 2049. The ending of Blade Runner 2049 was terrible. I enjoyed the movie, but the ending was like, are you kidding me? I wasted over 2 hours for this crap at the end? The original Blade Runner was okay. So no official confirmation exists to my knowledge, but fans are excited about the potential skins and environments. It's supposedly a cyberpunk fusion driven by fan and media speculation right now. We'll see. I think it's going to work. I think if this is a preview here of it that I was able to track down. Hey, if you're a Fortnite fan, and I know a lot of young parents play with their kids. I don't play Fortnite. My take, both Blade Runner movies were a commercial flop, but they become cult successes. More Blade Runner than Blade Runner 2049, but both were box office commercial failures. And because it's a cult favorite, they're able to do a crossover, and you know, it just adds more greatness to Fortnite in terms of dominating the online free to play microtransaction industry in gaming. To give you an idea why I say it was a failure, both movies, the budget for Blade Runner, the original, came out in 1982. Oh my gosh. Wow, what is that? 47 years ago? Holy mackerel. Man. No. 38 years ago. Hold on. 43 years ago. Duh, my math. 43 years ago is when Blade Runner came out. Well, not quite 43 yet, but it'll be 43 this year. The budget was 28 to 30 million. It grossed about 34 million, but it needs to make a profit. It needed to make about 84 to 90 million, and it miserably failed. But it got money back, and the DVD became a bit of a cult on the licensing, the Sci-Fi Channel, I guess, in other places. And I don't know if it's ever made its 84 to 90 million back. I wouldn't be shocked if it has, but it's taken 40 some odd years. Now, the budget and gross for Blade Runner 2049 came out in 2017, about 150 to 185 million. It made 268 million worldwide. And you're thinking, well, William, they made a profit. No, it needed to earn about 450 to 555 million to generate a profit. And it fell short. Again, I saw that movie, and at the ending, I was shockingly surprised. I was enthralled in it. Like the first one, I liked the storyline, but the ending sucked. It was pathetic. The ending was beyond pathetic. You don't put your whole premise into the protagonist to go, oh, really? And I'm not going to get away. I'm not the guy. I guess I did give it away. but you won't understand until you see it. You know, and the whole, is Harrison Ford a bio or not? I'm like, no. And the whole premise of getting, it's just, it's really, truly way out there sci-fi. But the whole point of this story is it's coming to Fortnite, and maybe the cult status will continue to grow. And there you have it, my friends. Red, White, and Rude. My favorite TV show, Frasier, canceled. From fan love to fan disappointment, it was a harsh reality check. I'm sad to see it go, but yet understand why it went. And hope that bring Ken Levine and Suzanne Martin to the reboot if they're able to shop it to a different platform. And then obviously the Rude segment. Holy mackerel. Looking at all my notes. Woo. The Rude Rundown. I hope you enjoy the Rude Rundown. And do not forget to like and share this podcast. And you can find this podcast as well as my other podcasts at grumblingsmedia.com, my Fired Up Conservative Talk podcast, and my Points on the Board, where politics and sports collide. I don't always talk politics and sports, talk sports a lot, as that's where I made my bones. I am a pioneer in the fantasy sports industry. And you can find those at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora. I am William Del Pilar. And until next week, this is the Red, White, and Rude, and I bid you adieu.